Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet,
sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Hello and welcome again to another episode of the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet, I'm your host. Today I have Jenny Kerrigan. She's an author of Layla. It's a book about that covers homelessness, abuse, incest. But if you'd like to call in and talk to the guests, our number is 347-324-3460, 347-324-3460. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much.
Great. I guess to begin with, kind of tell us your story and how did you, where you're from, and how did you come to write this particular book?
Okay. I am, well, my story is written in the book, Layla, as far, at least the first half of my life. I was born in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and was raised in the Midwest, you know, typical Irish Catholic home.
Okay.
But I ran away. I ran away very young because there was a, well, obviously I come from a home where it was abusive, incestuous, and physically abusive. So I left, ran away, and got into a lot of trouble and walked into a lot of darkness. And but came out the other side. Came out the other side really well. And I wrote the book, started to write the book after my father died. Almost nine years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote the book so that people who have walked through the same darkness that I have can find their way out as well. So,
wow.
Yeah. The book is about all of it. The darkness that happened, you know, incest, abuse, runaway, rape. I was raped. I was abused. I was stuck. I was in the dark. And, you know, I think that the main theme of the book is for other people to say, hey, it's okay. It's okay that you've been in, you know, in this black, black place. Let's just polish it up and go on and be in goodness. Out of the book, also, we've put together a nonprofit called Ricky's Revenge, which helps homeless and the lonely and the lost on the streets to get to safety very quickly.
Wow. I mean, I haven't read the, I heard part of the story in the past. And so this is a good thing to cover. And I said, well, why are you covering it on the business show? But, you know, in a sense of a medium, I think to get the word out is more important because some people don't face certain things. And maybe it will hit someone that might, this story will speak to, that might be in that particular situation or who had been in this particular situation, and they can kind of begin to heal and recover and go on with their lives and make their lives much better. And if they motivate to share their story, they can go and share their story.
Right. I also think that, you know, people who have come to the other side, I'm good. I'm really good. I mean, there's been so many things that have happened to me, and I've been able to find my way into goodness. And the piece that I think that is important is it is kind of a business for those of us who are on the to get the word out, to get women off the streets, to get knowledge out there about domestic violence and rape and incest and homelessness, because it's still there. And the more that we can get the word out, the more we can help. And I think it's just that simple. So, it, you know, those of us that have written books and we have these nonprofits and we're really working hard in the business aspect to get awareness, to get support, to get money, to get everything that's necessary to get these people to safety, it's incredibly important.
Well, writing the book itself is therapeutic, you know, kind of by putting it down in writing and exposing the story. Did that help you?
The thing, I thought when I went to go write the book that I was okay. I really did. And then I started to write the book because it's not just about, you know, me, the victim, and what happened to me. You know, the victim, I, the victim, also became, you know, became pretty dark. You know, I come from the streets, so I survived by prostitution, by stripping, by drugs. You know, I carried a gun. I shot a gun at somebody. I mean, all of these things that I had become, I had to sit down and face, and I had to go over it piece by piece, and I worked really hard not to maximize, not to minimize, but to really be raw and honest, and I made it. The book is incredible. It's a fast read, but I think the biggest thing that it did for me is now I'm able to stand up and hold the book and to stand in front of people, whether it's 5 or 1,000, and say, yeah, this is it, and I'm okay. So I think the process of writing the book helped me to really get strong to stand for it. Because in business, when you're selling things, you got to be able to say, yeah, I'm proud of this. I'm really proud of this book, even though it talks about how dark I became.
You know, by telling the dark story, I think what people really appreciate is always the honesty. Because you never know in society today if someone has been honest, you kind of give you the real story. And I think that's what's so special about reality TV. Now, you know, they get a little bit more extreme, but you really see people in a raw sense. You can't be on your guard all the time. You don't know when they run the footage what they end up going to pick. Yeah, they would put some extreme things for ratings and so forth, but also you can peer into the person to see what that person is really like on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And it showed the good, bad, and ugly.
Yep.
I'm sure they have some flexibility in that, but it's just having a sense that you can tell a story without honestly and say, here is what it is. This is what it's like to come from a Catholic family. You know, it can be any family in a sense.
Right.
I'm Roman Catholic as well. And I'm not sure, you know, during your time, did you ever get a chance to talk to a priest or a mediator, someone as a school, say, hey, this is what's happening, before you just ran away?
No, you know, incest and sexual abuse is a real funky kind of a thing. It's difficult. It's difficult to speak about it. It's difficult to talk about it. I was raised in a Catholic home. My uncle is a priest. My father was in the seminary and was supposed to be a priest but didn't make it. So, I mean, my babysitters were nuns, and there was just so much silence when it came to what was really going on in the family at that time. There really wasn't a place where I felt safe, and my father was extremely manipulative. I mean, I was made to shut up and to not talk about it. I mean, I was actually pushed to do that. I was put in my first institution at 12 with a quote-unquote diagnosis of depression. And I think that my father worked pretty hard to keep me silent. That's a part of incest, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So, but eventually, yes, there were people that I talked to about it. It started to come out little by little. I eventually talked to my father about it. My father and I are at peace. He died with he and I bringing all of this to the table and as best as he could. I confronted him. We went there. So,
good.
Yeah, there
were
definitely spiritual people in my world. Yeah.
So the father is the one that molested you?
My father did most of my life. And then when I ran away, of course, I was a setup for several rapes and abduction. I was abducted by a truck driver at one point and beaten and abused. I was raped several times as a young child. But I think that I was, you know, the way that I carried myself, I was kind of a setup for it. I put myself in situations and positions that that were dangerous and were a setup for that kind of abuse. Yeah.
Kind of take us back a moment. If we look back, the period of this happening, did it happen in the 60s or 70s or the 70s?
It happened in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Late 60s, early 70s, because I'm 45 years old. And I'm just speaking on my behalf from where I grew up in. And there were, no, it was a different era in the turn of the century, the first half of that, the last century. Parents can beat their kids, can do anything. And not until probably the 60s, things start to turn. And then all of a sudden, right after, I think around 78 or 79, when I think this Book of Rights came out for children, that the tide started to turn. And I don't know what caused that. Maybe during the liberation of the 60s and
yeah,
liberation of the 70s, people start speaking up and say, hey, no, this is unfair to us. You can't do children this particular way. And just speaking on my own half of having you as a child, I felt, since I was the only child of a single mother, I felt like I was alone, and to the point that you don't have a brother or a sister can help protect you, can help speak for yourself,
right.
Then you're like alone in the woods, and anything can happen. And people, you know, adults during that time prey on kids. I mean, it's just amazing that you never suspect that will touch you inappropriately, will talk to you. And you're 10 or 7 years old. You know, I'm sorry, I don't need, no, I'm not going to sit on your lap. You know, I'm 7 years old, I'm independent. It's not like dealing with a toddler.
Exactly.
This is a little beyond innocent. And it got to the point that you kind of fear certain people. And even the Catholic Church, speaking for myself, I didn't have a problem with it, with the Catholic Church, but it was something with me with men and people that gets too close as a child. Hey, no, I'm going to stay my distance here. I don't have nobody to speak for me at all. And being a boy, nobody's going to speak for me. And so even, you know, my career has been within the Catholic Church, but I always stayed that distance because something in my head was telling not to allow those particular opportunities to even happen.
Exactly. But women and or men, boys who have been sexually abused from a very young age, say 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, they don't have that cognitive ability to say, oh my God, this is wrong. They were raised with the fact that it was something that happened on a regular basis. So when somebody else approaches them when they're 7, 8, 9, 10, they don't have that reaction that says, oh, something's wrong here. Now, it may be they're, you know, I mean, I remember at one point thinking, oh, this isn't okay. But my father was sexually abusing me from, you know, very young. So it became somewhat normal. And it became repressed. I mean, it was totally a repressed memory. At night, it would be horrific and it would be horrible. But in the day, you know, my dad, I was daddy's little girl. You know, I was his favorite. So that manipulation got to be, it just mixed up my brain and the cells in my body so incredibly that I just didn't even know what was reality. You know, so there's so many different dynamics with people when they grow up with this kind of thing. I think that the most important piece is to educate now that we can speak, you know, now that we're grown up, we can say, look, this is wrong. It wasn't right. I mean, even what's happening in the Catholic Church, it's all coming out. You know?
Yeah, and I'm not going to fault the church. I mean, I'm fault the individual for that.
Yeah.
And it's not the church. I mean, it happens in other religions as well.
Absolutely.
It's just and anything is people who put in a position of trust. Same thing with Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
And you hate confronting somebody, you know, an adult with that, and it's hard to believe in your heart. Is this person really taking advantage of children?
Exactly.
I mean, it's just a reality. I mean, just think about it. You work with children all your life. Is he really taking advantage of somebody's child? And even today, the last 25 years or 30 years, the consequences of just even touching them inappropriately, if anybody sees that or if the child reports it, it's not going to be your word against his. They're going to kind of investigate you and try to prove that you did it. You're guilty first. Then, which I'm glad about, you know, I understand some people would be accused wrongly, but however, at least they're listening to, for the last 30 years, listening to that the victim for the first time and say, hey, we're going to take this seriously first. You're guilty. It's up to you to, in a sense, kind of prove what didn't happen or what was misconstrued.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad children's rights have that. And taking that, you know, that became normal for you, as you're saying, your dad say what was in him that he couldn't see in, you know.
My father, you know, the saddest story is the story at the end of my father's life. Now, you know, he was trained to be a priest. He was raised in the seminary. He was dedicated to the Catholic Church, became a deacon, the whole thing. The saddest part about what happened in my father's world is it was a few days before he was about to die, and he had cancer-ridden. He asked me to go home and take care of him, and I did. I can't believe I did it, but I did. It was the best thing that ever happened to us. I went home to that house, And he wouldn't take medication. He was rigid. He was just sitting there. He was just angry. He was just all bundled up in himself. And then finally, we came to some kind of explosion. And it's in the book. You can read the long version in the book. But the short version is, I'm like, Dad, you know, why? Why are you so miserable? Why are you screaming at your children? And, you know, why is this going on? And he looked at me, tears running down his face. He said, Jeannie, I'm going to hell. And I'm like, what? And he goes, Jeannie, I'm going to hell because of what I did to you and to others. I'm going to go to hell, so please don't let me die. He was just petrified. Now, he was raised at a time in a seminary where he told me, then the story spilled out, he was sexually abused in the seminary. And he said, you know, by the time I got out of the seminary and I failed becoming a priest, he did, and that was shameful. They put him in a Catholic college. And the first woman he sat next to, whom he was petrified about, was my mother. And, you know, they ended up together. But the whole dynamic was the silence. He was made to keep silence. Don't speak about it. Don't talk about it. Don't open up about it. And it crushed him. It just crushed him. And he had so much sickness in him that he kind of spilled out on me and other people. You know, and that doesn't mean that I have to say, gosh, it's okay what you did, Dad. No, I didn't say that. I'm like, it's totally not okay. You ruined my life for a long, long time. But I forgive you. You know, but I love you, and I don't want you to die angry, and I don't want you to die thinking you're going to hell, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was able to put my arms around him and say, you know what, you just lived your hell. Your hell's over. You know, go, be free. And he did, and he died.
Wow. So how old was he that he said he was abused?
He was young. He was put in the seminary at the age of 12. It was I think it was, you know, it was what you did. You gave your sons away to the church to be priests at that age. And my uncle and my father were the only two children in that family, my grandmother's. And she sent them to the seminary. They were very young, 12, 13, 14, 15. They stayed there until they were, I think, 17 or 18. And my father said, you know, when it was time to take your vows of celibacy and become a priest, he couldn't do it. He kept throwing up, I guess. He said he kept puking, and finally somebody came in and said, you know, maybe this isn't your way. Maybe you're supposed to go another way. My uncle did make it. His brother did become a priest. So they were raised there. Yeah.
So he said he was abused.
He was abused in the seminary. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Since he was abused, do you think well, let me see if I can put this right. Because he was a victim, or was it in him, if that makes sense?
You know, my father was a victim. My father was a victim of a lot of things. You know, I mean, there was also things probably going on in his family. I think that what he brought up, was brought up with, and what he watched, and what was squashed in him, what he wasn't allowed to be free with, I think that that was a big part of what happened to him. I mean, my father over the years tried very hard to be good. But the fact is that boys who witness domestic violence or incest, they are twice as likely to abuse when they become adults. It's been documented over and over. So he wasn't allowed to be free either. And it's the same as me, and I do the comparison in the book. You know, I was abused, I was a victim, you know, and I turned out to be, not that I never perpetrated sexual abuse on anybody, but I became pretty dark, you know. I hit the streets and I was angry. And for me, the era was the 70s, you know, when the drugs were ending, but the violence was still there, and I was part of it, you know. I have to own it. I became dark. You know, I think that I was becoming as dark as my father until, you know, some people walked into my world to say, I love you. Yeah.
And that's all you needed to hear.
Well, I heard I love you. I heard you were born good. I was actually taken in by Native American people who taught me to heal, taught me about God, taught me what God meant. I was so angry with the Catholic Church, but I also knew. I mean, I knew when I was really little that there was a God. I got that. I would see things, I would feel things, and I wanted it. But it was actually a Native American healer who really helped me to see that the world is a good place. Yeah.
Wow. So, taking that from the day you decided, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. I'm just going to leave home. What was that day like when you made up your mind and you just walked out of that house? What was your feelings that day that gave you the courage to say, I'm not dealing with this. I'm going to walk out. I'm leaving. I have it.
I wish it was that way. I wish that's the way I left, but it's not. You know, I was trying to get out of that house for a long time when I was little. I mean, I think the very first time I tried to run away was I was in Catholic grade school and I went down the street. But the thing is I got to my friend's house, you know, and of course within the Catholic Church, everybody knew everybody. They called my parents immediately. I could not say, I'm unhappy because my dad is touching me in the night. I couldn't say that. So by the time I actually really did leave, I was lured out of the house by drug use, by the street life, by this horrible desire to find something different. So I didn't walk out saying, I'm done with this. I walked out feeling really horrible. I left my sister. I left my brother. They were both hurting. I felt guilty, really. I felt guilty.
Okay, mm-hmm. So did you have a place to go?
No,
or you...
I know. I would just hitchhike. Well, this remember, early 70s, so I would hitchhike down the road. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I would hitchhike up north, or I would hitchhike down the road, or there was, you know, a group of people that I was partying with, a lot of us that were doing drugs, like I said, horrible. I mean, some of us were, I was shooting drugs at 14, so.
So you already had an outlet to deal with the stress.
Yes, I did.
So
yes,
when you did leave, you had some place, a culture to go into that
brought
you
I had a culture to go into, exactly. I had, and we talk, I mean, I talk about this quite a bit in the book, you know, the culture. There was a place where I could go where people were like me, and I eventually found them, and that was the streets. I could be a mess. I could be bad. I could be sad. I could be all those horrible things that I, you know, that were closed inside of me along with the other people. I mean, there's this kind of radar on the streets where we all sort of find each other and become a community. Become our own community, you know, like help each other. I mean, my best friend in the stripping world, she was amazing. She was beautiful, and she was abused as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
from that, you segue, you went into the streets, homeless. Did you just live in the streets, or did you go to a shelter?
At certain times I was in the streets. I was a runaway. I did, you know, I did pretty good. I mean, I got a job once, and I lived in an apartment, and got sent back home, or, you know, I got raped. My first time out, I got horribly raped, and I did end up going back home. And then I was put in a hospital, like I said, at 12. And then I would run away again and go to different places. I mean, eventually I think my parents just let me go. And I got raped, and I got raped. I finally ended up in an institution, a long-term treatment program at the age of 15. And then I ended up finally in a girls' home. And I graduated from high school in a girls' home, again, running away from the girls' home. But the woman who ran that home, her name is Mrs. Chase, was amazing. She was a grandma, and she loved me no matter what I did. I could run away and come back, and she never scolded me. She just wrapped her arms around me and made me chicken soup. And let me tell you, that was the coolest thing ever, was that home, Mrs. Chase's. So I did end up graduating from high school there in a girls' home. And then I was emancipated. I was put on my own. And I went to college.
Oh, wow.
At 17,
so,
yeah.
At 17. So how did you survive college?
It was horrible. It was horrible. I mean, the only reason I graduated from high school is because I had this loving, beautiful roommate in the girls' home. Her name was Margie, and she helped me. Oh, my God, she helped me. But I didn't know a whole lot. I couldn't even add. I couldn't do anything. So I sat in the back of the room in college. I took two classes, the only two that were open, because my mother thought it would be a good idea if I had something to do. She was right. It was a really good decision. But I couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. I couldn't write. I couldn't spell. I couldn't participate in conversations. It was still really political at the time. And I just couldn't. I remember it was presidential elections class. I couldn't even vote. But eventually I got better. There's a story I tell in the book about a professor who saw me. He saw me.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me an A+ on a paper that had horrible spelling and punctuation, but the writing was good. And he came up to me after, and he said, this is the best paper I've ever read. And he said, if you do nothing else, continue, go to school, go to college. It took me years and years, all of my 20s, to get myself together, to get myself out of it. And I tried and I tried, and I went back to the streets, back to prostitution, tried again, got, you know, it took all of my 20s to work it out, but I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Going to the streets, and when you made the decision to prostitution was your job,
you know,
in one sense. Or,
you know, it wasn't a decision. I'll stop you right there. It wasn't really an actual decision for me to say, yes, this is what I'm going to do. I kind of slid into it as things started falling apart. As my, I mean, I didn't, I wish I could say, you know, I did it to support my drug habit. I wish I could say that because that would get me off the hook. But it was a choice. I mean, the uglier I got inside of me, the deeper I got into the streets. And I slipped into prostitution, really. I mean, I fell into it after my brother committed suicide. And I was so angry. I was so angry. I was so lost and I was so confused. I just went to where I could be angry, and that was the streets. I mean, literally, it was within a month after my brother's suicide, I went, you know, I can't swear on the radio. I was like, you know, to hell with this. I am so gone. I'm so angry. And I didn't have a way to work it out. I didn't have the memories anymore to even know why I was so mad that my brother's suicide, what the dynamics of what happened. And it was actually that suicide that kind of took my family apart. My parents divorced after that. Things started to come out. It was actually, you know, sometimes darkness can be the door that opens everything, and it was. And my brother's death was the door for all of us to say, okay, we have to look at this black, because, like, Jeannie's dying, you know. My mom's divorcing my dad. My dad's pulling into his own little world of whatever was going on, which we found out later when he was sick. And, you know, here we are falling apart, and why? And so it was that event that, I mean, I got angry, I exploded, it didn't take very long, I almost died with cocaine addiction or, you know, cocaine use, it almost killed me, and that was the end. It was like, that was, it only about a year and a half after his death, I was on the grave of the love of my life crying after cocaine use, going, okay, what do I do? Because I know God's out. I know that there's light. I know there's love. I know there's goodness. I don't know how the hell I'm going to find it, but I don't want to die. So that was the end.
Okay. Dealing with drugs itself, the conversation to kind of make a layperson understand, somebody listening, or some people have addictions for certain things. Some people have addictions for food. A compulsive cleaner, kind of tell us, in your words, what is it like to be addicted to cocaine? Kind of tell us a mental picture, real simple,
cocaine?
To make people understand. It was cocaine you mentioned?
Well, I was addicted to a lot of different drugs. I mean, I think the physical addiction, I've done a lot of it. I've shot up drugs. I mean, in our day, shooting up reds and speed and heroin and all that stuff, that was there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the drug will get you. You know, accidents happen. Cocaine was a whole nother world. That was a drug that, I mean, the minute I did it, I was done. I had to have it all as much as possible. Now, you can't do cocaine every single day for 10 years like you can heroin. You know, it takes you down really fast, really fast. That drug knocked me for a loop. I thought I had control, and I had none as soon as I did cocaine. And I didn't just snort it. I hit the pipe the first time I did cocaine, which was wow. I mean, as soon as I had it, I had to have more. It took me to a place that almost, it took me to that almost heaven place. The total opposite of, and I'm not saying heaven, I'm saying almost. It takes you just to the edge of what might be incredible, but you never get there. That's addiction. You never get there. It's false.
It's the rich.
False. Yeah, it's a very false picture. You know, it's a mirage. But, wow, you keep going for it. You keep going for it. That mirage, it's just in front of you, and it looks beautiful, and it looks like water, and it looks like it's going to spill goodness all over you, and it never does. It kills you.
Is it the feeling when that drugs start taking effect, or do you see things, or
It's a feeling. I've done acid trips where I've seen things, you know, when I was young. And, of course, that was great, but, you know, you come down from an acid trip, you can't stay there forever. You have a psychosis, you know. But it's a feeling. It's just a feeling that runs through your whole body that grabs you. I mean, it totally grabs you. And, you know, you want it again and again and again, and you can't stop, you know. And of course, some people say that in the disease, I worked as an alcohol and drug counselor after I got out of it, and, you know, they say it's a disease of addiction. You may be genetically predisposed to want this feeling over and over and over again, because I know some people who have done cocaine and say, oh, my God, never again. That was horrible. Have a different personality, you know what I mean? So it could be that there's some sort of something in my brain that says, click, I want more, I want more, I want more, until I go to a near death.
How do you quit? You know, how can you pull yourself all of a sudden from coming from that high, and all of a sudden kind of say, I want to stop, but I can't.
Well, you run out of money, number one, because it takes money. It takes a lot of money. It goes really fast. Number two, your body gives out when you're doing that much. You know, I mean, at some point, you're going to fall asleep or you're going to go down. The paranoia with cocaine, for me, I became extremely paranoid. The other thing that I had going on is that I'm a good person. Anybody who's a drug addict, anybody who's out there on the streets is a good person. There was a part of me that really did not want to be there. I wanted to be good. I couldn't. I wanted to be happy. I couldn't. I wanted to forgive. I wanted to not be abused. I wanted to not pick up a gun. I wanted to be good. Everybody on this planet was born good. And I think that there's a piece of that that is still in people. And I was a mother. I had a child at the age of 18, and I wanted to be a good mother. I loved him like I'd never loved before, oh my God, and I really wanted to be good for him. So I tried and I tried and I tried for him, and I made it.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, we have a caller. We have someone on hold real quick. We're going to go and talk to them real quick if they have a question. And
sure.
Then we'll continue to talk about that book.
Okay.
Caller 505, I have you on the air. Do you have a question for our speaker?
I just want to say hi to Jamie. I'm kind of mad at her because she never signed my book.
Where are you?
When it's coming back to Santa Fe. I'm Oscar Guadarrama.
Oh, Oscar, I will be there in May. Good to hear your voice.
May.
I will be there in May.
Okay, I wait to see you here.
I will
so
be
good
there.
So good to hear from you. And you're good. You're fine.
Thank you for buying the book. Thank you for buying my book, Oscar. I will be in Santa Fe in May.
It's not about buying your book. It's a big gift to the world. Your book is, I mean, thanks for writing that book. It's a big inspiration from many people.
Great.
So
well, thank you.
See you soon.
I will see you soon, and I'll sign your
thank
book.
Thank you, Oscar. Thank you.
Okay.
How wonderful is that? That's beautiful.
Yeah. See, it is truly a ministry. And I have a question. You know, we talk about Whitney Houston. I mean, talking about, you know, people who are on the top of society, you know, they own the ultimate high because you're rich, you're famous, you have everything going for yourself, and addiction, you know, and you have a God-given gift, and someone opened the door for you and gave you the whole world, even towards the end. Clive Davis was still giving her, he'll do anything, you can see it in his eyes, over wherever she was at. He was there for her, but he couldn't help her with this one particular issue.
Yeah.
And you kind of told us exactly what the addiction is. I mean, she struggled for out of height of her career from the bodyguard on, I think when she mentioned, then when she started to lose control. But you gave us a point of view that a lot of people don't really get to see. How is that particular feeling, and why can you just break it? And even she had the resources, which is even harder, because, I have the money. I mean, that's not really an issue.
Yeah.
You can.
Yeah.
And I can rent a jet. Yeah.
The best way that I can talk about it, and I feel for her, I really felt for her. The day she died, I mean, it just broke my heart, because she did the same. She tried. There's so many people that tried. You know, and I have to tell you that there's something else. There's something that we're not reaching, and that's my goal. I wrote Layla because so that we could reach it on a cellular level, on a fundamental level. There's some kind of pain that somebody didn't get to. And I spent years and years and years in therapy trying to get to what is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? How come I cannot squeeze this out of my brain? Well, I think it's because it's not a cognitive functioning. It's literally an energetic, cellular, I'm bad, I'm horrible. At a very young age, there were things that were done to me that were a part of my development. And I work now as a therapist. I work in a somatic body work, so I'm helping people to get the trauma out of their body without having to re-traumatize. And at the same time, you know, filling their body with good energy. It's like, okay, this is negative, and this is stuck, and this is stuck in your body, and it's not your fault. And here's your beauty. Let's move the trauma, and here's the beauty of who you are. I think that a lot of people don't get that part. You know, Whitney, did she get the fact that, wow, she was born good and a bright light? I don't know. Somewhere along the line, that was taken from her because she tried. She tried. Like me, I tried. You know, it took somebody else to pick my head up and say, Jeannie, you were born good. Do you get it? You know, And I think more people need to hear that on a somatic, vibration, energetic level. You were born good. That's a huge piece.
So, in taking that, you know, you have two different worlds here. The girl who is abused physically, sexually, incest, homeless. And then there's the boy who has parallel universes, but the way they cope with things differently. And with a boy, it kind of questions his manhood. And it brings like a different dimension altogether. Both are extremes, but one, if it's a male to male, it really puts him in question. And it's like you took something from somebody, but then you're taking a sexual identity of this particular person. How can they recover? What advice do you say on both ends for the little girl or the young lady and the older person to how to cope with that and how to get help with that? And on the same thing, how can the boy do the same thing? Because I know you, since your foundation has a lot of resources, where can they go? Who can they talk to? And then the second part of that question is I want to talk about, did your mother have a sense that this was happening?
Everybody wants to know, where was my mother? We've talked. My mom and I are very, very close. My mom has had her own healing. She was also sexually abused. But remember my mother, I'll talk about that real quick, and then I'll get to your next question. My mother was a Catholic wife. I mean, she was raised in the Catholic Church, and she stayed home and she had her babies, okay? Baby, baby, baby. By the time she was 30, she had six of us. So, and my father was, you know, and perpetrators don't just have this violent behavior and then they return to normal. They have a dynamic, a way that they live. He was controlling. He was a child emotionally. He was needy. There's all kinds of things that go on when you're a perpetrator. Your self-worth is shot, and so you've got to get your self-worth from somewhere. So he was manipulating a whole lot of things in that home. So when I finally confronted my mom, I was like, Mom, where are you? And I need to say, my mom showed up for me very early. When I confronted my father, she wrote a letter to him, and she said, look, you better own up to this, because Jeannie's falling apart one more time and it's totally yours. She was great. But what she did say was, she said, Jeannie, when your dad got out of bed in the middle of the night to go smoke his cigarette, I went to sleep. I was so relieved. He was abusive to her as well. So he was out of that bed. She could sleep, and it was the only sleep she would get. And I'm sure she went into a deep sleep. You know what I mean? And I think that the other part of it for my mother is, you know, the last thing you want to know is that this man that you've been living with for 30 years or whatever it happens to be, or that you do love, you truly love, when violence is wrapped up in love in an I love you package, it's really difficult to unravel. So I don't think she knew the details. I don't think she knew. Later, when she heard them from my mouth, yes, she stood for me. She was great.
But did she say she have a feeling or something, or she just really
couldn't
come to the terms to believe that?
Yeah, I think the pieces fell together for her, yes. There were feelings, there were things that were going on for her. I think for anybody who lives with someone who is abusive or incestuous, yes, there's this gut feeling or maybe there's this gnawing thing that's going on that's underneath the surface. But it's very difficult to speak about it. It's very difficult to say, yes, you are abusing your daughter, and I'm, you know, yes, it's difficult. And
okay.
I have to tell you, my father was really, really good. He was so good. I mean, he was a public figure. He was a prominent man in the church. He was the dean of the department at the college. You know, that he supported the police, and there was so much that my dad did. On the outside, he was incredible. He was outgoing and loving and giving and volunteered and supported financially other, you know, associations. He looked on the outside amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to say this is what he was really doing, most people would have looked at me like, yeah, she's just a juvenile delinquent. There's something wrong with her.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the advice that you have for the girl and the boy who has two different dynamics this.
I wrote this piece. There's this piece about one of the rapes, and I was anally raped, and it was horrible. I was young. I was like 13 or 14, and I was raped, and it was anal. And I wrote the details of that in the book. And I got a message on Facebook from a boy who had been raped the exact same way, and he said, "Jeannie," he said, "I felt exactly the same as you." So the rape is the same, the degradation is the same, the shame that I felt being raped like that was horrible. My face was in the dirt, and this man was on top of me just shoving himself all over me. I crawled into a corner, into a bush, and just hid for as long as I possibly could. I didn't want to be seen. I can only imagine what that's like for a man. I can only imagine what that's like for a little boy. You know, I can go to somebody as a woman and now and say, oh, my God, I was raped, and I was raped in this violent way. For a man, there aren't as many associations. There aren't as many groups. Now, they're out there. They're out there. You can find the guy. You can, and there's a lot of men that have been raped, more than we will ever know. You know, the domestic violence acts and the places for people to go are for both men and women. You know, RAINN, R-A-I-N-N, is an association that works with all incest victims, including men. And they do some great things on their website for men. There are places for them to go. But I think there's a whole other dynamic of low self-esteem and shame that goes with the boy. And I'm not taking away from what happened to me. There's the shame for a woman. I mean, it was horrible, my body. I mean, look at, you know, and a lot of the male prostitutes that I know in the streets were also abused. So the dynamic is there, but yeah, I think the shame is individual to each person. It's horrible. To each personality, each little entity of beauty is assaulted in every way. Mm-hmm. And that is unique to each person.
So kind of take us, I know there's help real quick, before we talk about some more details regarding the book. For people that are homeless teens, those associations for victims of incest or rape and drugs, do you have any resources on your website to kind of direct them to where to go?
Yes. Yes, if people go to my website, JeannieKerrigan.com, or they go to Ricky'sRevenge.org, what we do is I had a little bitty monkey that I carried with me always. You know, I was a little girl, and I think I told this in the last show. You probably heard it. And this little monkey I would tuck inside of me, and it was just when I was alone at night sleeping in the back of a gas station or whatever, I had this little monkey that sort of was my little safety. Well, I lost that monkey on the final rape in my world, where I was abducted by the trucker, and I was, you know, held hostage for about a day and a half. When he put me out, or when the trucker put me out on the street, I was in Atlanta, Georgia. And what actually got to me was not the fact that I was raped and abused, because by this time it had been going on for so long. It was the fact that I left Ricky. What we've done is mm-hmm. we recreated that Ricky, and on the Ricky's arms are the runaway hotline, the incest hotline, safe house hotline, all the numbers and the text numbers so that kids who are on the streets can get help right away. If you're in it and it's happening to you right then and there, you can actually text and somebody will find you, or you can find a place to go to safety if you're lost and you're alone. You know, the thing that we didn't have when I was a kid was cell phones. We didn't have that. We had to find a payphone, you know what I mean? And by the time we would get to the payphone, I sort of had myself together. But in the middle of the crisis, when it hurts the worst, you can text a number or call an 800 number, and you can be found. We're also in negotiations to get refurbished phones to stick into these little monkeys' pockets.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a little bit of time on that phone and those emergency numbers, you can just hit it and you can be saved.
Wow. And mm-hmm. so, okay. And I know on your Ricky campaign, you have a goal of $20,000. Then they're going to go and contribute to that through PayPal.
Yes.
But
Ricky's
also,
Revenge.
I know that.
.org.
Yeah,
keep going.
And Kickstarter also have a program. I think if you write another book in the future, I mean, I'm sure people will be willing to hear your story, and you can even pose to that, because a lot of people just will give to certain things that they believe in, like
right.
books and
mm-hmm.
and movies and things like that. But I will advise anybody, I mean, if you go to your church and your church is not listening, there's United Way, there's your school.
Yeah.
Your school will going to be on your behalf. Just go to talk to somebody. Don't be
yeah.
embarrassed. Say, hey, I just have I want to meet with you briefly. And that kind of put everybody's guard down. They're just going to think it's something. But talk to them in private. Don't be afraid. Even if you're male or female, say, hey, this is my situation. And believe it or not, with the school, with leaders and authority today, they're held accountable if you say that. They have to take action right then and there. And it's nothing embarrassing. They would do it really discreetly. They will inform the authorities, or they will work on your behalf, because once you report it to them, they will find opportunities for you.
Right. And I think the other thing that's important to say is if you call RAIN, or if you call, you know, if you're in a domestic violence situation or an incest situation, there are some times where if you report it, you're in danger. The next thing that will happen to you is you'll be killed or you'll be beaten. So there are places, like if I go on the RAIN site and I can click and I can say, please erase this from any cyberspace, and I can talk to somebody and nobody knows that I'm there. That's the other piece, is that sometimes
mm-hmm.
when you report it, if you're in a domestic violence situation, you will get killed. So there are places, some of these national organizations, they help you through that piece as well.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's important to say. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you for adding that too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a way to get out, and you know, I think one person mentioned, you know, once you make that decision, you don't go and get the things that you like from your home. You make it then. You get your
mm-hmm.
children, and
mm-hmm.
you go. You know, if they go to daycare, just go to somebody. You go. You leave
yeah.
everything behind. There's nothing is going to be that sentimental that is going to put your life in jeopardy. I think some people make the mistake of going back. Don't go back. Once you have your family, go. And
mm-hmm.
then they will take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
Anything last words you would like to leave with the audience?
I think my biggest thing is, if you've been abused or if you're in a situation, if anybody's listening and life is hard for you, please call one of the hotlines, start talking to somebody, start the process of talking to somebody, get help, get my book. If you buy my book, it also goes to support Ricky's Revenge, but the book itself is a way out. When you get to the end of this book, it's incredible the changes that are going on with the women and men who have read this book. It is designed so that people can change. I also think that if you've never been abused and this has never happened to you and you can't even understand it, know that it's out there and support it somehow. Support your community, support your shelters. They need money. Runaway shelters need money badly. If you have it, give it, even if it's just a little bit. Support these nonprofits, because we really, truly, truly, truly want to wipe it out. We want it gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And tell us where we can get the book from again.
You can get the book on Amazon.com. You can get it in, you know, a hard copy, or you can download it to your Kindle. You can get it off my website. That's probably the two easiest ways, of course, Barnes & Noble. But it's easier if you just go right online and grab it from there.
Okay. And your website address to share?
www.jeannikerrigan.com or rickysrevenge.org.
Great. Thank you for coming on the program. I really, really appreciate it. And I hope this would be your ministry is great and it's something that's needed and people need to hear. And we're definitely going to rebroadcast this and probably have you
thank
back
you.
On the show again to talk about a little bit more detail. Wish you all the best. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me and for doing this on your show. I really appreciate you.
Great. Thank you again.
Okay.
Again,
bye.
This episode, have a great day. This episode can be downloaded on iTunes or Blog Talk Radio. Feel free to share it. It's free. And if you don't mind, when you go to iTunes, just give a review about these episodes, you know, or give some words of encouragement on iTunes to say that you like it. It kind of helps get the show, this particular episode, up there that people will see and link to and listen to. And it's all about helping people. It is not by really for us to sell things. We do as a community service. Thank you for listening to the show. Everyone, have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to the Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.